The language pattern. In my own experience with ayahuasca, as I reported it in Consciousness and Shamanism, I made an amazing discovery about language. I quote, "And the intelligence seemed to tell me telepathically that I was locked in language, that all my experiencing of life was conditioned upon language, and that I hardly ever perceived life directly, spontaneously, as an immediate connection." End of quote. I knew that this intelligence was connected to all, was connecting all, and was all. It simply was, and it gently invited me to enter this connection, this all-encompassing love that it irradiated. I quote, "The intelligence seemed to wanting to free me from the conditioning I had received through language and through using language for describing reality." End of quote. What this extraordinary experience taught me was that language is needed, as Freudian psychoanalysis strongly emphasizes, as part of culture, so that we can say that there cannot be culture without language. However, what this intelligence conveyed to me was, so to say, the other side of the medal. Language is part of culture, but not forcibly part of nature's own intelligence. Or I might express it metaphorically the way that nature's language rather sounds like when, before the symphony starts, the musicians test and tune their instruments, usually by playing the A unison. Culture's language, then, it goes without saying, is the symphony itself, a written score, well-defined, well put in print, well black on white, while the attunement of the instrument sounds like a form of chaotic improvisation and is volatile and up to the moment, not fixated, not written down, not put in print. Language serves social conditioning, or the other way around. Conditioning is in our mainstream civilization done by language, by verbal language, first of all, and by emphasizing the early acquisition of language skills by the young child. I certainly was conditioned that way, perhaps more than others. My mother told me that I already began to speak at the age of 7 months, and by the age of 12 months my verbal language capacities were as good as complete. My mother had been a radio speaker, and her language training was very astute, which is a great advantage for me today as a writer. But it also has strongly conditioned my perception of reality. I seem to perceive reality more than most others through language, and less through visual input, which is, however, the way most people function in our terribly visual culture. In my research on tribal cultures and shamanism, I found that nature-abiding cultures have a much more general and encompassing notion of language. Language is understood primarily not as verbal language in the sense we use it in Western culture, but as a notion that encompasses the telepathic interchange with other language realms, such as the animal and the plant realms. Language, in this sense, is communication in every possible way, be it by sound, be it by thought, be it by gestures or movements. It is clear that such a holistic notion of language, as it seems to be common to most tribal cultures, leads to a more subtle understanding of nature, because it is cross-lingual, so to say. When I dispose only of human language, and spoke I 12 languages, I will still not be able to communicate with an animal or with a plant. The native may also want to master the languages of other native tribes, but he will for that reason not neglect to master what I may call the universal language, which is a form of sensitivity that includes telepathy and that is founded upon a deep interest in other realms of living. Thus, I must ask, what does culture in fact mean? If it is only a system of restrictions, if it seems to be a stupidity factor in human development, when I compare it to the much deeper wisdom of nature. Culture that defines itself as distinct from nature will use a distorted language. This kind of culture, which is ours, is created by perverted language, conditioned language, and restricted language. In native cultures, which are true cultures in the sense that they integrate nature, I observe the taboo is a restriction of action, but not a restriction of language. When I see that, I understand that taboos that prohibit language are not only impeding communication, but destroy culture. The prohibition of talk creates human beings that are mute, people who have to use other forms of communication than verbal expression. Thus, they use violence. This is the status quo of modern international consumer culture, where worldwide terrorism had to come up in order to show even the most ignorant members of society what degree of collective violence we have attained. And we have attained it not by talking, but by being and remaining mute. Tribal cultures, in their natural wisdom, know all this and care for the importance of language and the fact to put words on things. Within native cultures, taboos such as the incest taboo, as well as taboos that concern the world of the spirits, are do taboos. They are not talk taboos. What is prohibited by the taboo is the deed, not the verbal expression of the tabooed behavior. Furthermore, in those cultures, there are special festivities that are focused upon humanizing the taboo through its verbalization. Language humanizes the taboo and integrates it into the individual and the collective unconscious. The spirituality of man is in first line its capability to humanize our social behavior through verbalization and doing this to create culture. However, a taboo that represents a mere non-dit will not preserve culture but destroy it. For the tabooed behavior cannot be comprehended as long as it is not humanized by language. Any possibility to communicate it is cut off by the talk taboo. Talk taboos are the result of hypocrisy and undermine the taboo, since what is not talked about is done secretly while it is denunciated publicly. Talk taboos are thus against democracy, since democracy implies free speech. It is for this reason that language education and the support of the young to express their emotions and all what can be said is so overwhelmingly important for the formation and preservation of culture. This was historically the case in humanistic education, which was based on the study of the old languages and the Hellenic tradition. These antique cultures, namely, had less talk taboos than our today's mass cultures. After the end of the Hellenic era and the beginning of the moralistic epoch of mankind, namely under the influence of post-Platonic and Christian thought, language was more and more tabooed, and the possibility of complete dialogue more and more narrowed. With good reason, psychotherapist Robert M. Stein calls Judeo-Christian tradition primitive in the right sense of the word, because it's undeveloped on a level of what I might call cultural cognition. I quote, "Creative psychological development, individuation, is dependent on spiritual freedom. When we say, for example, a man has a free spirit, do we mean that he freely or necessarily transgresses the imposed manners, mores, and taboos of his culture? I think not. But it does mean the freedom to do anything or go any place he desires in the imaginal realm. He is a man who has clearly distinguished the sacral, timeless world from the secular, historical world. He knows he can move with unashamed dignity among the gods and demons which belong to the mundane world. Such freedom cannot occur with a primitive form of consciousness in which inner and outer reality are governed by the same laws and values. In this sense, our Judeo-Christian tradition is primitive in that our thoughts and desires are subject to the same dogma, the same regulation as our deeds. Spiritual freedom requires a break with biblical tradition and the development of a new form of consciousness, a consciousness which promotes the cultivation of imaginal freedom. End of quote. Cultures that prohibit language, such as ours, are in truth no cultures, as they are in their very root against freedom and against culture. They are barbarian, authoritarian, and tyrannical. Their well-sounding democratic setups and constitutions do not alter this fact and contribute rather to veil the truth. The way to personal freedom and creativity, to autonomy and the detachment from collective categories is only possible through individually building a culture of language, the civilization of personal expression. Only on this very personal and individual basis, culture can be created for the community. For language is every kind of expression, everything a creative mind may come up with, not only speech and writing, but also every form of art, of expression that leads to communication. Our asocial instincts and our perversions can only be humanized through language. There is no other way. Without language, the process that Freud called sublimation of the instincts is impossible. In case that a given society lacks language to express our social behavior, repression takes place, and what is not integrated is disintegrated, repressed, and projected. All collective tragedies of mankind were and are accompanied by collective psychosis, a process that breaks through the fragile balance of repression and brings to the surface the primary archaic patterns of behavior. It is the same on the individual level. An ego without language is a psychotic ego, and to create collective muteness means to prepare individual and collective psychosis. The Tao of psychic health, then, not only for the individual, but also for entire cultures, is the way of language, of communication, and the active use of speech and writing. To realize this, it is not enough to write well-sounding guarantees in national constitutions and otherwise shut up as a politically correct citizen. An eminent expert on the importance of observing the formation of language in the human baby was the late Françoise Dolto, 1908-1988, the famous child therapist from Paris, France, whom I have known personally. I visited her Maison Verte in Paris in 1985 and interviewed Françoise Dolto after the visit in her apartment. An interesting correspondence followed up to our meeting. Françoise Dolto was a pioneer of child psychoanalysis, made unique discoveries in this science, and was known for her remarkable, if not miraculous, healing successes with psychotic children. In my observation, her success was due to a unique and almost shamanic understanding of language, which, of course, includes the direct telepathic language of our subconscious mind when it bonds in dialogue with another human's subconscious. In the daily practice of the Maison Verte, a center for parents and children, the difference with conventional approaches to parental counseling becomes obvious when, for example, the child is greeted first when he or she arrives with their parents. Children bring their parents, Françoise Dolto used to say. The fact that the parents remain anonymous has been a very important detail in the good functioning of the place. They are identified as Jacques' mom or Helene's dad, which was a very elegant way to protect the parents' anonymity while creating a language system that is child-oriented. Without anonymity, most parents would not have come to the group in order to discuss family problems. The insistence of Françoise Dolto upon language and the way to say things may sound strange to people who have never heard about psychoanalysis. To remedy this lack of knowledge, there is no better way than to read Françoise Dolto's extensive publications and to learn from her extraordinary penetration of the matter and her wealth of experience. In the Maison Verte, it is first of all the child that is spoken to, however not in the usual way people speak to children, but as one would speak to an adult. Babies are addressed as Monsieur X or Madame Y, while they are shown around the facilities when they come for the first time. Françoise Dolto revived an old tradition from the European aristocracy. In fact, more than 200 years ago, it was common in aristocratic families to address even small children with the same forms of politeness as one addressed adults. Consequently, the children are neither kissed nor fondled, nor found being cute or else when greeted by the receptionists. Tenderness, such is the philosophy, has its place only in relations between parents and child. The verbal communication with children is painstakingly truthful and serious. No lies are told to children. When a child, for example, says it had no father because the father left the mother, the center assistant would insist, I quote, "But of course you have a father, although you do not know him. Both your parents have created you in their loving embrace, your mother and your father. Your father has participated in your procreation with his body. You see that you certainly have a father." End of quote. There are no truths of life that are hidden in front of children. By the same token, assistants are specially trained to avoid allusions that are unclear and subject to misunderstandings. Facts of life are named and explicated. Even though parents are discussing intimate things, children are not complimented out of the room if they want to stay with their parents. Nothing that concerns the child is discussed behind his or her back. In many cases, nothing but the respectful, rational, pragmatic and fearless way of handling relationships in the Maison Verte leads to solutions in behavioral problems with parents and or children. Fixed roles are thus easily dissolved and more flexible and creative forms of behavior can be learned. The press often spoke of miraculous changes with people who attended the house. One of the main goals of the Maison Verte was to prepare small children for daycare. Françoise Dolto, before she opened the center, had come to the insight that an immense number of children are traumatized by prematurely entering daycare. Not only the child needs to be prepared, Dolto found, but also the mother. The sudden separation from the mother for long hours of daycare can represent one of the greatest shocks for the small child. Contrary to most daycare institutions, where the transition of the child into daycare is facilitated by a gradual extension of the time span the child passes in care, the Maison Verte practices a different approach. Not the adaptation for separation is the decisive factor, but the maturity of mother and child for the separation. Often, Dolto found, the children were ready for it, but the mothers not. The result was that the mothers gave to their children highly contradictory messages, which were actually the reason for the children's emotional disturbances. For example, a mother would affirm to the child that daycare and consequently a separation was needed, but telepathically suggested to the child that she herself was not ready to stand the separation without immense emotional suffering. On the other hand, children were found to be not mature yet for the separation when the mother had firmly decided to give them in daycare. The Maison Verte ensures that both mother and child are ready for the separation. This is of special importance within the current nuclear family structure, where children are almost exclusively fixated upon their parents.